Today's lesson, truthfulness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Truthfulness is a light which radiates its reality in its own world. It is like the sun from whose reality everything seeks light without any decrease occurring in this reality. A truthful person, in fact, is a man who believes every liar due to the reality of his own truthfulness. It means that nothing which is opposed to truthfulness, nothing even which is not truthfulness, is permitted to coexist with it, just as happened with Prophet Adam alayhi salam, who believed Iblis when he lied, because Iblis had sworn a false oath to him, and there was no lying in Adam. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in the Quran, "We did not find in him any determination." Chapter 20, verse 115. Because Iblis originated something previously unknown, both outwardly and inwardly. Iblis will be gathered with his lie, and he will never benefit from the truthfulness of Adam, Prophet Adam alayhi salam. Yet it benefited Adam. One can wonder how. It benefited Adam that he believed the lie of Iblis. How? And this is something we would like to explain after a short break. But remember, truthfulness is that light which radiates its realities in its own world. It's like a sun from whose reality everything seeks light without any decrease occurring in the reality. Welcome back to your listeners. Before the break, we raised a very interesting question. We said that Iblis, of course, did not benefit from lying to Prophet Adam. But Prophet Adam, who believed the lie of Iblis, he did benefit from it. The question is how? Let's try to solve this riddle. Well, it benefited Adam that he believed the lie of Iblis, as Allah testified for him when he said that he was not constant in what was contrary to his custom. This really means that his being chosen was not at all diminished by Satan's lies. Truthfulness is an attribute of the truthful. The reality of truthfulness demands that Allah purify his bondsmen, as he mentioned regarding the truthfulness Prophet Isa on the day of reckoning. He indicated it by referring to guiltlessness of the truthful men of the community of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he said in the Holy Quran chapter 5 verse number 119, "This is the day when their truth shall benefit the truthfulness." Brothers and sisters, sometimes in today's time and age, and the world, the type of world, the wretched systems of the world, they make us believe that if you're truthful, you're naive. You're not being intelligent. Being truthful is not going to help you in this world or the hereafter. This is an utter lie. Being truthful is something which, in the long term maybe, in this world, will definitely benefit you. And in the hereafter, there is no doubt about it that the truthful are the only ones who become successful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at ParseToday.com Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Activists on the ground fear public concern for the disaster-struck region in Louisiana is already waning, leaving people in a state hit hard by the COVID pandemic, vulnerable to widespread hunger and houselessness. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading, It's Not Just a Loss of Electricity. Ida left people houseless and jobless. Stay tuned for more. In Louisiana, residents and advocates were already bracing for a wave of hardship and home evictions across an economically vulnerable region when Hurricane Ida slammed into southeastern Louisiana recently, destroying homes and businesses and displacing tens of thousands of people during a COVID surge. The storm left entire communities without power and clean water for over a week and countless workers without a paycheck as rents came due and federal pandemic supports dissipated. For Louisianans in Hurricane Ida's path, the last-minute decision to evacuate their homes or shelter in place for the deadly storm was only the beginning. After the storm passed, came days of sweltering heat without power, the scramble to put tarps on leaking roofs, the days of waiting for the phone and internet service needed to apply for federal disaster relief that many still have not received. For those who evacuated, the cost of living on the road piled up alongside the anxiety of deciding when to return to disrupted lives and damaged homes. Activists on the ground fear public concern for the disaster-struck region is already waning, leaving people in a state hit hard by the COVID pandemic, vulnerable to widespread hunger and houselessness. National attention quickly moved to the East Coast as Ida dumped heavy rains and caused widespread flooding in New York and New Jersey that left dozens of people dead. In the lower-lying and coastal parishes that took the brunt of the storm, the recovery could take years, according to August Krepel, principal chief of the United Huma Nation. At least 11,000 of the Huma tribe's 19,000 members living across the five parishes hit hardest by the storm have been affected. Krepel, a firefighter who worked day and night over the past 2 weeks providing disaster relief, said the United Huma Nation has spent decades fighting for federal tribal recognition and the enhanced support and disaster relief that comes with it. Back in New Orleans, organizers fear a wave of evictions will erupt after an order from the state's Democratic governor pausing legal proceedings expires on September 24th, further displacing people who survived the storm or attempt to return after evacuating. Many people in the Crescent City and across southeast Louisiana work low-wage jobs in the service, tourism, and retail industries and could be without work or a paycheck for weeks. Louisiana cut off pandemic unemployment benefits in late July, and the Supreme Court struck down an already weak federal moratorium on evictions just days before the storm. Less than 14% of the $248 million in federal emergency assistance for home renters in Louisiana has been distributed so far, compared to 67% in Texas and 100% in New York, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Recently, the New Orleans Renters' Rights Assembly released a list of demands calling on the city to keep its eviction court closed until all the federal rental assistance is distributed and at least until the end of the year. The tenancy union said an additional $500 million in rental assistance is needed across the state. Last summer, protesters blocked and shut down the city's eviction court after local and state moratoriums on evictions expired, an action that made national headlines and put pressure on federal policymakers to implement a national eviction moratorium. Activists say the rental assistance program, which is administered by the state in rural areas and by city officials in New Orleans, is in need of an overhaul. Instead of requiring renters to produce onerous amounts of documentation and making relief payments to landlords, housing justice activists in New Orleans and beyond say people who fell behind on rent during pandemic lockdowns should receive assistance in cash, a model that has already proven successful in other communities. The tenants union say the city must also provide a dedicated multilingual staff to help people with disabilities apply for rental assistance and disaster relief. The tenants union is also demanding the right to return for all residents displaced by the storm, including renters who live in damaged homes. Even if legal evictions are temporarily halted, organizers fear the landlords will neglect badly needed repairs, forcing people to either live in uninhabitable homes or go someplace else. Louisiana has few legal protections for renters who can receive an eviction notice after withholding rent for any reason, even if that reason is a giant hole in the roof. At least 350 oil spills were reported in southeast Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico after Ida, according to reports. The days spent without electricity in the hot sun prompted more urgent calls for solar energy, an obvious solution for maintaining power for residents during a natural disaster. If more homes and businesses had solar panels connected to community microgrids and power banks, thousands of people could have kept refrigerators and air conditioners running, which can save lives during heat waves and other climate disasters. New Orleans residents are still clearing debris and repairing damaged homes after most of the city spent over a week without power. Many households emptied their refrigerators during the power outage, and the smell of garbage hangs in the summer air.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. Welcome to today's brand new episode of Youth Station. We're coming to you not live from IRB English Radio, and in the studio with me, I have my brother in faith and humanity and co-host in the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRB English Radio, and you are listening to the Youth Show. And I am your co-host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
At
your
Sayyid.
Service.
How you doing?
Alhamdulillah.
You good, inshallah?
Can't complain. Always, as long as I'm alive, I'm good.
How old were you when you left home?
Maybe 19, 18. I got married.
You got married when you were 18?
Yeah, 17 actually. I spent a couple of years with my parents and then I moved out. I'm just trying to follow the sunnah. So because people will say, well, why so early? So the Ahlul Bayt, the Prophet, they were emphasizing on people getting married at even a younger age. Actually at Belul, which these days it would be a crime, literal crime, you will be in prison for it. So if you marry at 15 or 16, that's a crime in a lot of states.
Right. You left home because...
So I got married. I have a wife. I need to start my own life. So I rented a house, moved out.
How did you make a living at such a young age?
It was very tough. And I assume it's the same now. Nothing has changed because I was a student.
Uh-huh.
I was going to university at the same time. I have to take care of her house. So I had a job. So I would do night shift in the morning, go to university, come back home, sleep for a few hours, and then go back to work and do the same thing over. So it was a very, very hard few years of my life. But alhamdulillah.
Did it pay off? Do you think it was worth it?
Well, everything is worth it at the end of the day. Life is just experiences.
Mm-hmm. I left home when I was 16 also, but for entirely different reasons, thank God.
You can share with us if you like.
I left home because very normal, conventional reasons. I left home to study, to pursue my studies, and then...
Mm. So that's another reason for leaving.
Definitely. That's definitely one of the reasons for leaving. And then, you know, one thing leads to another. You find a career path close to what you studied, close to where you studied, because it's usually interconnected somehow. I haven't seen most of my family in, I'd say, about 4 or 5 years.
Okay, so you don't find the need that you need to go back and live with your parents once more.
Actually, not find the need, I don't think I can anymore.
Well, that's a different story altogether.
Right? Because you feel like you're established as a person now.
Yeah,
you're an adult.
Yeah. So
and
you don't
I
need
firmly
and
believe
daddy.
That other than spouses, no true adult is or should live together.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, each person has their own set of rules and set standards and what's right and what's wrong. This is how, you know, I want to live my life. This is how my home should be. This is what I'm comfortable with. And if we live with anyone else other than our spouse, which is supposed to be a partnership, it kind of just, you know, it's going to be chaotic. What other reasons can you think of? You left because you got married. I left because I wanted to study. What other reasons do you think are there?
Well, I mean, when it comes to leaving...
Leaving
your parents, obviously, you would have your own reasons. So either work, either study, either traveling. Or either you just want to be independent. Like, you know what? I work. I could be 18, 19, and I could work, and I could own my own house. And I, you know, like you said, you need to have your own stuff, your own things, your own... life as you imagine,
sure.
As you vision it. So you move out to a new apartment and you rent to yourself. And sometimes maybe you get kicked out of the house altogether.
Yeah.
Right? So
definitely.
Maybe there's, you know, problem in the house and you get kicked out. Or sometimes maybe there's too much domestic violence in the house that you decide to run away.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which happens to a lot of
which
people.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
It's insanely sad.
Yeah,
no
so
child
we have a lot
should
of,
have to go
yeah,
through that.
We have
that.
A lot of these people these days. We have a lot of kids and youth who had to flee to shelters and stuff like that.
And, you know, often the situation doesn't get better.
And it doesn't. Once it starts as a violent a house, it will always be violent.
Exactly. Yeah, and like fixes. Those children who flee their homes in order to find refuge elsewhere also, in most cases, yeah, they won't find a better place or any place.
Yeah.
But see, we talked about, all right, marriage, the tragic case where a child has to run for their life, studying, career, maybe, you know, if you've already studied like 4, 5, 6 years in college and then you get a job opportunity in, I don't know, Amsterdam, you'll move out, right? But does such a concept, you think, exist within Islamic definitions? Because you see, a lot of cultures, they study, they get married, they have careers even, and they're still living with their parents.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say Islamic, because as far as I know, Islam does not set limitation on the age and time where you should be with your parents and the time that you should leave. Now, there's a great emphasis on making sure your parents are happy, because sometimes you could decide to make a move and that will really upset your parents because they're attached to you, they love you so much, and they don't see the reason that you're moving out is valid. So, for example, I say, Dad, Mom, look, you know, I'm working, I got everything, I just need to have my own apartment. And your
it
mom
depends
says,
on culture, for sure.
So that's what I'm saying. So Islamically, we don't have such limitation. And then culturally, yes. But for example, you know, because I brought that example, because if that's going to upset my mom, so Islamically say, you know what, put your interests and you want, obviously.
I mean, Islam doesn't necessarily emphasize on you having to stay with them for the sake of staying with them.
Yeah.
But Islam does emphasize on you catering to their needs if they are at a stage in their lives where they can't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
But that doesn't exist in a lot of Western. I emphasize on Western,
Western
because that's how it is.
Western countries don't have that. Western countries, it just became like a norm. Like 18, that's.
In fact, if you're not out, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, it kind of weird. They make fun of you.
You still live with your parents?
Yeah, it's become a stigma these days.
We'll leave that part of the discussion for after the break. We're going to be right back. Don't you go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
You're back here on Youth Station with me, Zainab, and my co-host, Sayyid Abdullah. Thank you so very much for joining us again. We've been talking about how old were you when you left home? In all honesty, wouldn't you say, as a person who moved out early in life and went through some hell of a journey in character building, being independent so early on in your life made you a richer, fuller, more...
Of course it does. Once you face life head on yourself and you get to suffer the pain painfully and slowly, it does make you stronger. What does not kill you makes you stronger. So it's definitely an experience. It definitely makes a person out of you, a man or a woman, because you get to see what life is meant to be. That a lot of the kids and or even adults who grew up in their parents' houses all their lives and they just had it like, you know, with a silver spoon in their mouths, they just weak people. Sometimes they just can't handle the simplest pressure of life.
Definitely.
But when you move out and for days, for example, you don't have food or you're out of money or you can't pay a rent or you can't pay the bills and you feel that pressure, you feel that pain. Obviously, it makes you a better person.
Yeah. It makes you a stronger person. I'm not sure if it makes you a better person, though.
Well, stronger person is a better person.
No, again, no. I don't necessarily agree with that. A lot of people
went
through a lot of...
being good, we're not talking about the virtuous good. Like, I mean, like, good in the sense that it increases something in you, at least your tolerance to pain. That's a good thing, right?
No, I don't agree with that either. Oftentimes, people,
we agree to disagree.
In order to be more tolerant of pain, they develop a thick skin, a strong shell, a big, huge guard. They become dysfunctional in terms of forming
healthy
relationships.
So you're just looking at the negative side of it, but
no,
the
that's,
positive
no, no,
side
that's
of
what
it.
I'm saying, Sayyid. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying being stronger doesn't necessarily equate being better.
Yeah, well,
or being
not
more
always.
Tolerant
Obviously
of pain isn't equivalent to being a good person. You know, sometimes you're a crappy person because you've been through a lot of crap, right?
Wow.
Moving
so
forward,
so it didn't add anything to you.
Yeah, exactly.
So I said if it adds.
Let's explore more the different dimensions of what happens to a youth when they leave their homes early on in life. Let's talk about the cons. The pros are independence, character building, experience, which is, you know, usually all good stuff. But the cons, especially in countries where it's the norm, Western countries, I am not sure if I can wrap my brain around the idea of my mom turning into someone I see once a year, you know?
Yeah. Well,
I'm not the one to talk. I saw my mom last 2.5 years ago, but my circumstances were different. Exactly. I live in another country.
No, they,
I'm in the pandemic.
Yeah, they can, but they don't. That's a different story. So in the West, that's the mentality of people being raised with, that you can see them only on the weekends. Oh, one
that's
is,
still
like
okay.
Said, yeah, it's still.
And we have hectic
not
lives.
Not really okay, but yeah.
We don't
okay.
need to see them every day.
Well, no one said every day, but at least, you know, you see, as kids, as sons and daughters ourselves, our relationship towards our parents is not the same as their relationship to us. The emotional feeling that we have towards them is not the same emotional feeling that they have toward us. So if I have, let's say, 10% feeling towards my dad or my mom would have 120.
Obviously, it's her job. Because
so she's constantly wants to see you, even you say, look, you know what, if I see my once a week, I'm okay. You know?
But see,
to them is a different story.
Yeah.
So yeah. You need to give them.
You know what? Now that I think about it, moving out makes both the parents and the children independent. Mm. Because a lot of parents are codependent on their children too, and it's not necessarily a healthy thing.
Well, that's a matter that
a psychologist
would look at.
Yeah. But. In a lot of parent-children relationship, it's the parents that have separation anxiety. It's the parents that are dependent. It's the parents that are attached.
Yeah.
And that's not healthy for either
parents,
of them.
Look, if the parents get too attached, obviously that's affecting the child. It will affect the child. Now, I think the hadith from Imam Sadiq salamullah alayhi, where he says, اتركوهم سبعاً أدبوهم سبعاً علموهم سبعاً, and then, you know, like, leave them for 7, teach them for 7, befriend them for 7, then leave them when they get 21.
Mm.
Right. So I can understand from that hadith that at age 21, the child, if he spends 21 years of his life with his parents, he gets the proper vitamins and neutral, and what's the word?
Trainings, nutrients.
Huh? Nutrients. That are in the form of emotions. So he's emotionally ready, he's mentally ready, and after 21, you say, you know what?
Now go embark on your new journey.
That's it, you go, you have everything.
But or perhaps it means that up till the age of 21, do whatever training you want. When they're 21, there's no more training to be done.
Yeah, so they
you can't like...
Exactly. So if we say if it's at 21 and it's past that age and the parents still wants to hold on to their kids and they are dependent on them...
That's messed up.
That's very messed up.
That's messed
up. It messes up the parents and the child.
Oh, yeah. That's all the time we have for today's episode. Sayyidina, as always, it's been a pleasure and an honor chatting with you. And to y'all listening to us at home or in the car or at school, I hope it's not in class. Listen to your teacher. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness. And my love is strong because you are the one I call.
in the limelight.
U.S. strategic interests are well served supporting despotism in the world. Defending the American public from terrorism has never been Washington's priority, says David Waring, writer, in an article titled 9/11 Attacks. U.S.-Saudi relations are proof that war on terror was a lie. Stay tuned for more. Proof of any connection between 9/11 attackers and mid- or low-level Saudi officials would undoubtedly be a significant story. But there is zero chance that the regime itself would have sanctioned an assault on the United States. After all, the House of Saud has long been virtually dependent on Washington's protection for its very survival. As Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan appears to mark the end of the 9/11 wars, there are deeper and more profound questions to be asked about U.S.-Saudi relations and what they tell us about the so-called war on terror. Let us recall what we know about the origins of the threat from groups like Al-Qaeda. There are two interlinked grievances on which these groups feed. The first is the prevalence across the world of corrupt governments lacking popular legitimacy. The second is the support provided to those regimes by external powers as well as the direct military interventions in the region carried out by those same powers. In principle, such grievances might express themselves in any number of ways. In an earlier period, they were mobilized predominantly through various forms of quasi-socialist anti-colonial nationalism. More recently, in a case of groups such as Al-Qaeda, the animating ideology is one of fundamentalism, which explains both the extremity of their methods and their comparatively far more limited appeal across diverse societies. Such groups are only able to emerge from the shadows in failed states and ungoverned spaces where the suffering of the local population is so acute that they may be willing to temporarily acquiesce to these groups' presence in exchange for the provision of basic security and governance. If this confluence of grievances, ideology, and material conditions is what produces groups such as Al-Qaeda, then the U.S.-Saudi alliance can only be seen as a major driver of this form of terrorism. The House of Saud is the epitome of ruling class corruption in the region, having run the kingdom's economy for decades as a family bank account, enabling avarice and embezzlement on an epic scale. Arms and security guarantees supplied by Washington represent a formidable obstacle to any Saudi seeking to take their country down a different path, and have played a significant, perhaps decisive role in keeping the regime in power. The Saudi kingdom has also established itself as the hub of a wider regional network of authoritarianism, sending troops into Bahrain and cash to Egypt to facilitate the crushing of the Arab Spring in early 2010s. Again, Washington is the ultimate sponsor and guarantor of this repressive regional order. Through massive arms deals, training for regime security forces, and the large-scale presence of its own troops and military apparatus. Meanwhile, direct and indirect Saudi interventions have exacerbated civil conflicts from Afghanistan to Syria to Yemen, thus helping to sustain those ungoverned spaces in which terrorist groups flourish. In each of these instances, the United States has provided vital assistance. We'll be right back. if Washington's priority is to defend the United States from terrorist attacks, has it embroiled itself in this toxic relationship with the House of Saud? Put plainly, the answer is that defending the American public from terrorism is not Washington's priority. Rather, the prime strategic objective is to project U.S. military and political power into the leading oil and gas-producing region of the planet. This posture provides Washington with significant structural leverage over its main geopolitical competitor, China. An additional benefit is the wealth extracted from regimes like Saudi Arabia in exchange for Washington's protection, which comes in the form of massive investments in the U.S. economy and the purchase of U.S. government debt. So U.S.-Saudi relations expose the lie that the U.S. government's priority since 9/11 has been the safety and security of the American people. But they also expose another lie at the heart of the so-called war on terror and of Western neo-imperialism in the 21st century. Throughout the past 20 years, we have been presented with a simple juxtaposed binary. On the one hand, Western values of liberty, democracy, even of secular rationality. On the other hand, a fundamentalist authoritarianism that has consistently been portrayed as virtually synonymous with culture of Muslim majority world. The so-called war on terror was sold by many of its leading champions as an existential showdown between these opposing forces. U.S.-Saudi relations expose this narrative as pure fiction. It is not merely that the U.S. regime is relaxed about fundamentalist authoritarianism when it is being practiced by its geopolitical allies. It is that this fundamentalist authoritarianism is an established and intrinsic part of Washington's presence in the world. It is a preference and a choice through which the U.S. has consistently pursued its strategic interests for decades. To externalize it as something alien and antithetical to the West is self-evidently a nonsense. The reality is that despotism in the world is often a joint enterprise between local elites and the Western powers they rely on for their survival in the absence of popular legitimacy. 20 years on from 9/11, it is clear that the war on terror has been an unmitigated disaster. The estimated combined death toll across all theaters stands at around 900,000 people, including over 300,000 civilians, with little substantive reduction in the terror threat to show for it. It is long past time to ask whether the things we told ourselves about the so-called war on terror were true. The U.S.-Saudi alliance would be an excellent place to begin that process of re-examination.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Insisting on the necessity to follow the health protocols concerning reopening mosques for prayers during the month of Ramadan, May 10th, 2020. The second point is that there is an unanswered question about praying and other religious ceremonies. Of course, I do not want to put forward any proposal to the National Anti-Coronavirus Headquarters about mosques, prayer halls, and the like. I follow the expert decisions made by the headquarters, but what I want to say is that praying and religious activities, in particular in the month of Ramadan, and in particular in the nights of Qadr, which are ahead of us, are one of the people's definite and fundamental needs. From one viewpoint, they are not that different from worldly needs, and from another viewpoint, they are even more important than worldly needs. The people need to be in contact with God to pray and to supplicate, in particular when important matters arise. Therefore, we should think of something for resolving this matter. I even believe that if strict regulations are imposed in this regard, our pious people and mosque frequenters will observe them more than others. In other words, if pious people are told that they should observe certain regulations when visiting holy places, mosques, and Husainiyas, I believe that those who are entrusted in attending mosques will observe them carefully. As I said, I have no suggestions in this regard, and I will approve of the expert and carefully studied decisions of the headquarters. But I recommend that you entrust this task to those who understand in the real sense of the word, the significance of dua, supplication, and spiritual matters. It is such individuals who should examine the matter and make decisions. Whatever decision they make, I and all the people will be obliged to implement them, God willing.
Ana mazlum Hussain, Ana mazlum Hussain, Ana mazlum
أنا لاتشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان
أنا لات
Hussein insisting on the necessity to cancel all religious gatherings in accordance with the regulations set by the National Committee on Combating Corona, March 22, 2020. I would like to reiterate again that everyone should act on the instructions given and announced by the officials of the National Anti-Corona Headquarters. They have even cancelled religious gatherings. Well, it is unprecedented in our entire history to cancel all religious gatherings in places such as holy shrines and public and Friday prayers. It is unprecedented, but there was no other option. They have determined it to be an expedient measure, and this is how they acted. The people should observe the instructions so that Allah the Exalted will help the Iranian nation, all Muslim nations, and the entire humanity get rid of this plague as soon as possible.
Footage shocked the entire world back in September 11, 2001. Soon after the attacks, Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility and named it a victory. Al-Qaeda's move paved the way for the U.S. to invade Afghanistan in almost 1 month after the 9/11 attacks, following Taliban's refusal to hand over Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden to Washington. Since then, Bush administration declared the so-called war on terror and promised to eliminate terrorism in Afghanistan, bring peace to the war-ravaged country, and establish political and economic stability, all under a U.S.-backed governance system. But 20 years later, the Taliban, who are now in charge of the control of entire Afghanistan, excluding some mountainous areas in Panjshir province, say they had already warned the U.S. of being defeated by Afghans at any cost.
We had already warned the U.S. of the consequences of invading our country when the 2001 incident happened. But unfortunately, the Bush administration arrogantly invaded our homeland. Today, even its successors have not managed to take full control of our country. The U.S. invasion ended up in failure.
Apart from issues such as establishing a strong governance system in Afghanistan or leading Afghanistan to development, the return of Taliban to power has proved that the U.S. was not able to defeat this already ousted group.
Now, the Islamic Emirate is ruling over the country after 20 years of fighting against the U.S. This is among main signs of the U.S. defeat in its so-called war on terror in Afghanistan over the past 20 years.
The U.S. war in Afghanistan costed billions of dollars for Washington. According to President Joe Biden, the U.S. has spent $300 million each day during its 20 years of presence in Afghanistan, with 140,000 U.S. and Afghan military and civilians, including women and children, losing their lives in the Washington's longest war in Afghanistan. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On Saturday, EU finance ministers wrapped up 3 days of talks. They say fewer bankruptcies have been recorded in the 27-country bloc than had been forecast due to COVID-19. However, current health trends are feeding economic uncertainty.
We have 13 countries seeing increasing case numbers, and some countries also increasing number of deaths.
Eurozone inflation increased to 3% last month. That's higher than desired. The virus continues to have an impact.
There are still more than 2 million fewer people employed than before the pandemic, especially among the younger and lower skilled.
We have been speaking to some of those affected.
It would be nice if it would be possible for the European Union to help each other and to find something that works for everyone.
It's difficult because we don't have a lot of opportunities in our country. I mean, the government doesn't put, student jobs as we have here in Brussels.
We don't yet know the full story because millions continue to receive government support to keep their jobs. Economists claim personal and government debt in the EU is too big to calculate. This as EU authorities say they are monitoring new COVID-19 variants.
Like the Lambda one and more recently the Mu one. The Mu one being potentially more of concern because of the potential increased immune escape that it may show.
Not only are the World Health Organization and others accusing the EU, US and UK of hoarding vaccines, critics say Western sanctions are hampering the efforts of foreign nations to deal with COVID-19. They say badly impacted places include Iran, Venezuela, Syria, Yemen, and Palestinian territories. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli arms firms with special relationships to Britain might seek to profiteer from a possible new refugee crisis following the West's chaotic retreat from Afghanistan. This was the warning issued by co-founders of the UK-based Palestine Action Group, who have long fought to shut down the UK branches of Elbit Systems, a notorious Israeli weapons manufacturer.
We've seen what's happened recently as well with, I think it was 800 people who entered this country, and there's talks of, you know, taking them back, etc., or stopping them from coming here in the first place. This is the technology that they will be using to try and stop people from seeking safety after many of these people have gone through war, have seen their communities destroyed, so companies like Elbit can profit.
Debates over the UK's commitment to refugees and treatment of illegal entry to the UK has resurfaced in recent weeks, with the government introducing stricter measures to halt illegal channel crossings of desperate refugees fleeing war zones. In past years, Britain has already purchased Israeli-built drone technology to track illegal entry attempts, with further purchases on the horizon.
It's been battle-tested, proven how it works in Gaza. So the same technology which is used to harass and surveil Palestinians. The UK are not only hosting Elbit sites to produce these drones, but they're actually making contracts to buy these very same drones in order to surveil the channel to stop migrants and refugees from seeking safety in this country. If you see someone about to be hurt, most people would step in the way. And that applies when we know that these weapons being produced here will be used to kill other people who, in a lot of circumstances, are powerless to what that weapon can do.
Both France and the United Nations have expressed grave concern at the UK's new tactics, which they feel could lead to many needless drownings in the English Channel, while Israel's arms industry is providing Britain the tools it needs in order to hunt down these vulnerable vessels. That's just another reason why Palestine Action feels so determined to see Elbit shut down. Robert Carter, Leicester.
After some 13 months of a deadlock in the country and a descending multifaceted crisis, Lebanon saw the birth of a new cabinet led by Najib Miqati. Miqati stressed that he will do everything in his power to stop Lebanon's collapse.
The situation is difficult but not impossible to deal with if we cooperate together as Lebanese. We need to work hand in hand. Today, the president and I work on forming this cabinet, and it is not perfect, but only God is perfect. I can assure you that we are a team and we will work as one until we stop all the despair. I will leave at nothing to contact all international organizations to try to provide the minimum of good living and at least stop the collapse.
Lebanon's new prime minister urged the political groups to cooperate and give this government confidence to work as a team. President Michelon told reporters off camera that the new government will begin addressing the concerns of the Lebanese, adding that Lebanon will get out of hell and rise from the abyss. A lineup of 24 ministers was announced on Friday from the Lebanese presidential palace.
The challenges this cabinet faces are economic, financial, monetary, and social. Therefore, it needs to hurry in putting together a solution plan. This plan should include short-term objectives and finding quick solutions, since this cabinet has only an 8-month term and therefore cannot put long-term plans. This is possible either through talks with the International Monetary Fund or through implementing the reform plan, which was endorsed by the French initiative.
With the government now formed, the Lebanese parliament will soon convene to issue a vote of confidence for the Miqati government. After a little over 1 month, Prime Minister Najib Miqati has finally managed to form a cabinet in accordance with President Michelon. However, the various challenges that lie ahead with regards to the socioeconomic and the financial crisis are far from over. Maryam Saleh from Baabda's presidential palace.
South Korea's weapons are rapidly advancing. Following the introduction of a larger class of submarines in 2018, the country last week test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile. This and other advanced weapons in development emphasize military deterrence against perceived foreign threats, including North Korea, despite calling on Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization and arms reductions. Activists argue such policies undermine national security.
The Moon Jae-in administration introducing aggressive and advanced weapons and holding joint military drills with the U.S. hindered trust building between South Korea and North Korea, as well as the Korean Peninsula peace process. South Korea's armed forces have been pursuing long-distance capabilities, for example, with a light aircraft carrier. This aggressive arms build-up plan could intensify the arms race in Northeast.
South Korea is in the process of choosing a light aircraft carrier, with two of South Korea's major shipbuilders intensifying competition for the project. Seoul Friday also announced it would build two larger SLBM-capable submarines. Activists argue South Korea's near $50 billion defense spending should be reallocated.
People affected by the COVID pandemic have not received enough financial support. Arms spending should be reduced and